Talk given Sunday, 17th August, 1975. The mind of God, the divine mind, or in Buddhist terminology, the all mind, or if you like to speak of it in complementary terms, the no mind, is wholly empty. Completely transparent. Now, starting that way introduces difficulties for us mortals. I'll put it in a slightly different way. We all know the manifestations of energy, which we call electricity or magnetism or heat, gravitation, and so forth. The different forms of energy we know. These are the second stage only which we know. Energy in its absolute nature we do not know. When there is a manifestation, we know. I have used the word empty, emptiness, in that sense. The mind of God is wholly empty. It is invisible, therefore, unborn. It knows no time, nor does it know eternity in the sense that we talk of eternity. It cannot. It's a dimension which is wholly beyond us. It is, in fact, transcendent. But this essentially is something for which in modern times we may use the word energy, creative power. And creative power in its absoluteness, as far as the mind of man can possibly penetrate, is identical with creative action. There is no such thing as creative power divorced from creative action. Please remember, creative action. Creation must be distinguished from procreation. Because procreation means the production of something which is true to type. Out of the acorn will proceed an oak. Out of human beings will proceed human beings. Mosquitoes will give birth to mosquitoes, and so on. We are all true to type. And as such, all things which are procreated live within their restricted sphere. And if there is restriction, there is mortality. There is birth, procedure, and death. But creation is absolutely new every time, which we don't sense, because our capacity, as we are at present, ends with the functioning of discriminative consciousness, which means that we are tied within the sphere of duality. We cannot break through this sphere into that transcendent dimension. So long as we function in terms of discriminative consciousness, vijnana. This must be carefully borne in mind. So, creation we never know. Procreation we do. We talk about the creations of the great artists, poets, and so on. Those are cultural procreations. They are true to type. A musician will produce songs, symphonies, sonatas, whatever you like, quartets, and so forth. But each of those different expressions, symphony, sonata, quartet, is true to type. Music in its absoluteness, we don't know, and never can know. What we can know with our consciousness, our discriminative consciousness, is at the very best the second stage. The primordial beginning is the unknown, the unknowable, and yet it is the experienceable, because it is referred to as that tremendum mysterium et fascinans, that tremendous mystery which is fascinating. Now this we must bear carefully in mind. As a thought, we can be aware and just postulate conceptually and verbally that the ultimate is the void, the emptiness. But we pretend to know it if we start trying to talk, to present the void as a concept or in terms of words. We can suggest that void. We can use words if we have somehow touched that void and the experiencing is a possibility and a reality. We can use words which can, if they are the right sort of words, produce a response from the listener who has reached that stage where something can emerge out of him and respond to this death. But woe unto him if he thinks that the words are the truth. The words are not the reality. They are a photograph, a picture of the reality. They are the clothes worn by the living reality, the emptiness, the void. A living reality, remember. As the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad put, the Chandogya Upanishad put it, Brahman, the ultimate, the absolute, is prana, life. It is living. It is not a mere abstraction thrown out of the mind of the imperfect man. Brahman is prana. Brahman is ka. Brahman is ka. Brahman is life. Brahman is joy. Brahman is this absolute emptiness. Now I want to use, let me put it this way. I'd like to suggest, instead of using this word empty and emptiness, which is very badly misused all over and misunderstood, that's why it's misused. instead of using the word emptiness, use the word transparent, transparency. There is a good reason why I suggest this. In India, they presented the teaching of Brahman and Atma. The Buddha used the terminology Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Bhavam, which I suggest is the exact equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma. That's all it stands for. Those people realized the same thing and they gave one word for it, Atma, instead of having a whole phrase. But in the Digha Nikaya as well as in the Majjhima Nikaya, you find this whole phrase used and put in the mouth of the Buddha. Discriminative consciousness, Vijnanam, Anidassanam, utterly characterless, you can't characterize it. Therefore you can't grasp it, you can't conceive it, you can't think it, you can't imagine it, you can't do anything with it. We are just the creatures of that creative energy, that creative power. Anidassanam anantam, endless. If it is endless, it is beginningless. It totally transcends the limitations imposed by what we experience as time. Or let me put it in a better form. It transcends the limitations imposed by our experiencing reality as a succession of instants which we call time. You see? Our consciousness, our awareness isn't whole, complete. Where space is concerned, we are aware of everything in three-dimensional terms. That is why we see a solid object. It is perfectly true that the three dimensions of space welded with the one dimension of time, the unidirectional dimension, is the, as far as modern science has gone, is the condition because of which an object which is called a space-time event can be experienced by us. I know this is all very difficult, but just try and feel it out, because we are going to come to something intensely practical out of all this. So you see, endless, anantam, pabham, shining everywhere, or paham, the other word, accessible everywhere, sabbato, paham, pabham. Everywhere, sabbato, accessible, shining. If there is something which is self-shining, it is utterly transparent in itself. Isn't it? Just as we cannot see or touch or taste or handle electricity per se, light per se, heat per se, so too this in terms of a transcendent mode of awareness, a state of a transcendent state of awareness. The Upanishads just used one word for all this, Atma. And one of its fundamental meanings is the eater up of the mind, our mind, Vijnana. It's really very wonderful when you go into the deeps and not merely study it and argue about it intellectually, but keeping the mind silent and quiet and empty of the clutter of ideas, beliefs, accumulated knowledge, and so forth. Then somehow the shiningness is there. It is always there, but your eyes now see this shiningness. That is your third eye functioning. It's the meaning of the third eye. One of the meanings, rather. So, the mind of God, of Brahman, of the divine mind, the absolute mind, the pure mind, use any phrase you like, is in itself empty. That which cannot be touched, that towards which you cannot move, from which you cannot run away, because you and I exist in it and it alone. We are totally subsumed by this transcendent mystery. Now, that is creative power, creative energy, creation, which goes on perpetually. We are wholly subsumed in this. We all know the theistic phrase, in him we live and move and have our being. Now it is very important to try and get the feel of it, just the feel of it. We can't grasp it, we can't grab it. But something in us, if it is quiet, utterly still and silent, will enable the sensing of it to take place in us. And when it takes place, one of the supreme realizations that comes to us is that I'm using the word I in the commoner garden sense, I am nothing. Nothing at all. Which of course completely contradicts our sense perception. We see this body. We can see parts of this body, most of this body. We can see ourselves in a mirror, or by an arrangement of mirrors we can see the front and the back and the top and the bottom and goodness knows what of all of us. All right. And with X-rays we can look into our insides even. We can touch this body. We can feel this body. Our emotions, our thoughts and everything we are aware of here in terms of our discriminative consciousness. So to say that I am nothing is a flat contradiction of that which we are conscious of through the functioning of our senses. This is the important thing to bear in mind. Through the functioning of our senses. But this is one of the great realizations that comes. I am nothing. And when this realization comes, every vestige of selfness is out. That functioning of our life energy and that functioning of our self-awareness, which makes us say that I am, is now completely transformed. And in its transformation, although this body as such as we ordinarily know it is here, this whole psychophysical organism is here, there is the actual realization of the transparency manifested through what we usually experience as not transparency. Now, if you can sort of somehow respond to this, that is to say, sort of just vibrate in tune with it, C and the octave above, or C and G, or C and E, but not C and F sharp, in which case you'll get a marvelous discord, you see. But if we can vibrate in tune with it, then we shall be very well aware of the inner nature of mind. We will be aware non-conceptually. We will be aware not in terms of mental sight, but in terms of mental touch. And the touch is all-absorbing. The sight is something which separates and divides. Now, if that happens, then for the first time we know the meaning of right-mindedness. Right-mindedness. You know how in the Noble Eightfold Path, as the Buddha laid it down, he talks of samadhi, perfect understanding, then perfect endeavor, aspiration, rather, perfect aspiration, perfect action, speech, samavacha, samakamanto, action, speech, and perfect thinking is involved in it. I very much doubt whether the Buddha meant thinking in the way in which we use the word thinking. I believe he used it in the sense of right-mindedness, as we have just tried to sense, which is very different from the ordinary way we regard right thinking. Now, why have I mentioned this? You know the emphasis which all the great teachers have laid upon mind. Mind is the thing that specifically distinguishes us human beings. Zarathustra, in his teaching, puts it very simply in a triple form. Vahu mano, the perfect mind, the good mind, the divine mind. The first attribute of Ahura Mazda, the Lord God of in Zarathustrianism, the first attribute is Vahu Mano, the perfect mind. And from the perfect mind, he proceeds to Vacho, the word, the divine word. Of course, Parsis, Zarathustrianism means mostly the Parsis of the world. We are only about 120,000 in the whole world. They translate it as good thought, good word, and then good deed. You can put it, use the other three words which they have, hu mata, the good thought, hu vacha, the good word, hu ktha, the good deed. see? But Zarathustra by mind meant the divine mind. By speech, the word, the creative word, in the beginning was the word. And the word represents creation as we can contact and experience creation in our way. That's why I said right in the beginning, creative power, creative energy cannot be divorced from creation. They are invariably completely associated with each other. And the deed, the good deed, is the final manifestation. Cosmos, not chaos. At the root of it all stands the eternal order of things, Ritta, as put in the Rig Veda. One of the deep meanings of the word karma, because karma derived from kri means to create, creative action. It is acausal. It has no ledger account of consequences afterwards to be worked out. It is creation, creative action. It is acausal. It is not within the, is not subject to time. It is non-repetitive. It is amoral, beyond good and evil. When the Upanishads talked of beyond good and evil, this is what they meant. And of course, all clever commentators and scholars and critics, well, they have to earn their living, so they've got to write what they write. This is what it is, this final creation, this final manifestation, which is cosmos, at the root of which lies Ritta, the eternal order of things, which means that things, as the actual things of the universe now I'm talking about, these things are the embodiment of creative action, divine creative action, and that eternal order which is inherent in such creation. You see now why Plato, for one, talked of beauty as the third great archetypal idea, the third one. Truth, goodness, beauty. All right. Now, let us come back to thinking, this word thinking. You know the advice given by the worldly wise people. They say, think rightly first, before you embark upon action. How does the world interpret that advice? Right thinking. All right, I must sit down and think this matter out carefully. Now, who is sitting down to think? I, a person in a state of mind which is ill, which is not at ease, which is liable to delusion, which is full of confusion, ignorance, has its conflicts, is the slave of its desires and ambitions and all the rest of it. I am sitting down to think. And what is the nature of my thinking process? A silent chatter of how I shall fulfill my desires and not be frustrated, how I shall be able to succeed with all my ambitions and ride roughshod over the world if necessary in order to do so, etc., etc., etc. This is me. Yours truly, the devil himself. Now, I start thinking, talking, chattering, completely self-centered. Then, because of my conditioning, the socio-cultural morality and idealism which has been imposed upon me and drummed into me, I say to myself, oh, but I mustn't be selfish. I must do this for the sake of my family, my friends, my society, my nation. And then if I can rise to such magnificent Everestian heights for the whole of humanity, even for God himself, I shall be the servant of God. What conceit? God never has advertised for any servant. So you see, the thinking that I produce before my action is just the usual thing which generates, maintains, and perpetuates the ill state, suffering. Suffering not to be understood merely as the experiencing of pain. Pain will always come. Physical pain as well as emotional and mental distress, spiritual distress too. That will always be there, because that is in the nature of the whole becoming process in time. That you can't avoid. You shouldn't try to avoid it. And that's precisely the mistake that all mankind has made, continues to make. Now, what is the energy which out of which expresses itself or gets expressed as thinking, conceptual thinking, verbal statements? This energy is the mysterious unknown thing we call mind, which is empty, which is transparent, which is universal, which is not mine, not yours, which is not at all subject to my criteria or evaluations, or confined at all to time, space, and so forth. It is infinite, it is immeasurable, it is the everlasting. You can say it shines perpetually, you can just as well say that it is dark perpetually. And the original Kabbalah and the original Veda used both terms, the darkness as well as the light. Poets like Milton have used that phrase. I have sometimes mentioned it. Dark with excessive bright. The great mystics, Christians, Sufi, Hindu, Buddhist, all of them have talked in these terms. Dark with excessive bright. If we are going to have right thinking, if there is to be any chance of there being right thinking, we must wake up to the fact that its root, its hidden root, is mind itself. Mind itself. Now there is no such thing as my mind. Just as there is no such thing as my space. I cannot put a notice board up and say that this volume throughout the universe belongs to P. Mater. You see, can't do it. In the same way, there is no such thing as my mind, no such thing as my eternal spirit, and all that sort of utter nonsense. I can't imagine how the world could have been so intellectually dull as to write such sort of stuff, to try and appropriate the inappropriatable. You can't appropriate anything infinite. Totally impossible. Try it. See what happens. See? So now, there is no such thing as my mind, but functioning through this living organism, there are phenomena which we may legitimately call mental processes. Mental processes take place. And when you and I use the word mind, it is to that which we refer. But we refer to it in a bad way. We say my mind. It has become so common that I also use the same terms, my mind or your mind. Can't avoid it. See? All right. So, our task is not a task of getting at mind, but letting mind function freely through you, the unresisting one. This transcendent energy, this universal energy, will function through that living organism which goes by your name or my name, as the case may be. Provided I let it do so. How do I let it do so? In order to explore that question rightly, let us look at the other aspect. What is it here in this organism that prevents it doing so? Because this is what I can tackle. You know how often I have said, you can't sprinkle cleanness in a room which is dirty. You can remove the dirt and the room is clean. Cleanness is constitutive of the thing in itself. Purity, perfection is constitutive of the thing in itself, in its absoluteness. It is all this clutter, this dirt, which it is our personal responsibility to remove. We know that we hate, we are jealous, and this, that, and the other. We imagine that we love and are kind and so forth. But look deeply into that kindness and love. At the back of our minds is the dirt of demanding reciprocity. I will love you and honor you and obey you. Oh, I'll do wonderful things for you, my dear, provided you do the same for me. If you don't, you be careful. I've got a very strong right arm. Isn't that true to life? Unhappily, it is true. So, our so-called virtues are caught within the ambivalence and therefore the endless conflict of opposing duals. Now the marvel is this. This is where what is called the grace of God or whatever you like functions. Theravada does not present grace. There are hints here and there. But the idea of grace doesn't permeate Theravada like it does other great religions. You find grace in Mahayana. You find it, of course, in Christianity. You don't see it easily in the Quran. But there is a suggestion here and there. So we can leave out those two. But in Zarathustrianism, in Hinduism, in Christianity, and in Judaism too, there is grace present. You see? Now, if we get hold of this very clearly, that grace can and does operate. If we pay attention, complete attention, to either dual, the kindness which we feel and manifest, or the cruelty. If we pay complete attention to it, a miracle takes place. You get right beyond the opposing duals. This transcendent dimension comes into being. You know why the psalmist said, if I make my bed in Sheol, in hell, I shall find thee there. How? Why? What is this hell that is mentioned, talked of? Inside here, the living psychophysical organism. What is heaven? If I make the star with the starry flight with golden wings unto heaven, what is this heaven? Just this here, this living organism. But it is caught up in the duals. Heaven and hell are both here. Pay attention to the hell, complete attention, and you will undergo purification. Purification is not a case of what we commonly imagine it is, the conversion of vice into virtue, or the throwing out of vice and preserving of virtue. That's all nonsense. It doesn't happen that way. This is wishful thinking and misdirected action. Pay complete attention to anyone, and everything gets transformed. And this is an operation of grace, if you like. Because the whole reality of grace has meaning and significance only insofar as it is related to and emerges out of a dimension, whatever it may be, which is transcendent to the dimensions in which I myself function and which I myself see and know. It is transcendent to it. Therefore, this happens. You can see that this is really scientific perception as well as intuitive or any other form of perception. This is how things actually do happen. So, cleanse the temple. This is the temple, isn't it? Not only St. Paul said, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High, and so forth. You find it in the New Testament, and you'll find it in the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads. The body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the transcendent. Shiva representing the creative power in the universe, actually acting, manifesting. So, this attentiveness. If the attentiveness is total, really intense, complete, what is the outstanding characteristic of such attentiveness? It is utterly free of isolative self-consciousness. Now remember, this is attentiveness, not in the sense in which one says that, oh, I was completely lost in the beauty of that performance, or whatever it was. You are not captivated. You are wholly awake. And in that whole awakeness, you yourself are included without the separativeness of self-consciousness interfering. See, this is what the whole thing is. This is the meaning of samadhi. Translated concentration. Samadhi. The supreme togetherness. And in this attentiveness, what has happened? It's no longer you or I attending to this or that, because that's all in the realm of separation. but it is attentiveness as constitutive of this one whole transcendent reality, the total reality. It is constitutive of it. How do they talk of Brahman? Sat, Chit, Ananda. Being or existence, if you like, but being is a better translation. Being and Chit is translated as consciousness. I prefer in this context always to translate it as complete attentiveness. Complete attentiveness, this divine attentiveness, this functioning of the mind of God which is utterly empty. And therefore not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. It immediately comes to life now, and is not a meaningless statement. So, when one is in this state of attentiveness, utterly poised, not captivated, but awake, everything is simple as simple can be. Everything is in a state of utter ease. It is in a state of purity. The transformation, the transmutation takes place. And right-mindedness functions through you freely. Then all the ordinary thinking process, the conceptualizing and the verbalizing, is in that of such a nature that it is least obstructive to the reality, to truth, to compassion, to wisdom, to beauty. And that beauty is your own beauty. Not own in the sense of specially belonging to you. You don't need to deposit it in the bank for safety. But it is your own beauty, because now there being no you, the totality has become you. You have become the totality in mind and consciousness. This is the meaning, the actual state of the Unio Mystica. In mind and consciousness, the totality has become you. Then your thinking is right thinking, perfect thinking. And your action is inevitably associated with it. You don't have to plan it out in the way in which we plan out things, think as we call them about things. It all happens naturally and sweetly. The natural course of things is no longer interfered with by a sick mind. You see, this is the meaning, if you like, in the profoundest sense, as far as I can see, that is always that proviso, of entering the stream. You have entered the stream of the waters of eternal life. What has happened? All separativeness of self has vanished. That's why I have constantly said through the years, there is nothing whatsoever for me. But when, as the pure, transparent drop, I am in that stream of life, there is no me, and there is no sulling of the waters of eternal life. Then things happen rightly, not in terms of our criteria. Cut that right out. They are useless. Mankind has just made a mess with his criteria for the last 4 million years, or whatever the figures are. Isn't that so? You see, when this attentiveness is intense like that, and the transformation has taken place inside, pleasure and pain, they'll all come. They will all have their outward effects, so to say, and they will all depart. You don't prevent them coming because you have a responsibility. You, utterly poised inside, feel the upset, the pain, and so forth. But if you are right-minded, one with transcendence, you transform that evil and send out into the world that which is pure and good. And so, you bear the sins of the world on your shoulders, if you like. Shiva and Vishnu, both represented as drinking the cup of the world's evil and sorrow to the dregs, transmuting it in their being. This is the transmutation which you effect. And that means you are wholly human, the happy creator. Is this religion or is it not? You must feel it out for yourself.